Do you know what makes me feel more human than human? A good cup of coffee! And like most coffee lovers, I know that the best stuff comes from fresh roasted beans. But most beans you get from your local shop or grocery store are roasted months before they get to the shelves. But your coffee drinking future need not be bleak! SparkPlugCoffee.com is a service that roasts your coffee beans when you order them and delivers them right to your door, anywhere in Canada, within a week. Their scientific roast process offers a consistently great product with lots of roasts and varieties to choose from. And SparkPlug offers a set-it-and-forget-it regular delivery so that you'll never run out of coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at SparkPlugCoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, Skin Jobs, and we thank you for hearing us gab about the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 123 most excellent American flicks. Heads up for spoilers. I am Ryan Ellis, seated beside that wondrous scientific wifely creation called Bev.
That's me.
And we're joined by our real dogs, not fake ones. No red eyes on these guys. Fox and Sam. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, Blade Runner, a favorite of many people. This will be the third straight AFI film that didn't receive any Academy Award nominations for acting. What's the next and final AFI film that didn't get at least one acting Oscar nomination?
Well, once you look at the list, it's actually easy. At first, I assumed it was Do the Right Thing, but then I saw Toy Story. Oh, obviously, it has to be Toy Story.
Yes, it is. And Do the Right Thing, Danny Aiello was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Of course, he was the white actor in the movie, so that was the actor they had to reward.
Although the guy who won that year was not white. Denzel Washington won for Glory.
Ah.
1989. Anyway, the Top 100 Project's 104th movie. Our name is no longer relevant, isn't it? Well, we only got about 20 more to go. So anyway, it's Blade Runner, and it was not on AFI's 1998 Top 100, although it was at least nominated. Then was 97th in 2007 between Do the Right Thing and Yankee Doodle Dandy. Warner Brothers released Blade Runner on June 25th, 1982. The flick was not a success in theaters, but found new life on home video. Okay, Bev, for those who don't know, describe Blade Runner for them now.
Harrison Ford is Rick Deckard, a bounty hunter in a sleek but bleak futuristic LA, who specializes in hunting and killing artificial humans called replicants. While searching for four escaped slaves led by Rutger Hauer's ferocious Roy Batty, he is introduced to the Tyrell Corporation's newest replicant, Rachel, played by Sean Young. And he falls in love.
Or to nutshell this movie, unretired detective murders his own kind. Or does he? He does. The biggest theme in Blade Runner is Deckard a replicant. We'll get to that in a second. Not many numbers to talk about because, as I said, the movie did fail at the box office. But the Rotten Tomatoes critics' numbers are very consistent. They're the same from both critics and audiences. 91% apiece. 87 fresh from the critics and 9 rotten. I'm guessing they didn't like the characters all that much, and that was one of the issues that longtime critic Pauline Kael had. She appreciated the extraordinary style, not so much the story or the characters. Roger Ebert reversed course on this movie, didn't like it the first time, did when they re-released it, and changed a lot of things. And anyone who's a Blade Runner fan knows most of the things that were changed, including the narration that was taken out. One more way to set the table here. The other movies that were released in that same time frame, and this may be one of the reasons why it didn't succeed, it came out just after The Wrath of Khan, the second Star Trek movie. It was released the same day as The Thing, which also failed, and 2 weeks after E.T. And also the last two AFI films we've covered. Fun, light, bouncy, for the most part. Raiders and E.T., and now this is completely the opposite. And also, you got the past in Raiders, the present in E.T., now the future in Blade Runner. Future we've almost cut up to now. It's 2019 is when it's set in Los Angeles, where it's always raining, unlike the Los Angeles of now, where it never rains.
I know. No, it never rains in Los Angeles. It's notorious for having the most beautiful weather in the world. Mm-hmm. Yet in this movie, it never stops raining. Also, futurists at the time maybe didn't anticipate that smoking would become the crime of the century in that part of the world as well.
Okay, well, let's hear what you think about Blade Runner.
It's remarkable to look at. It's remarkably copied over the years. Mm-hmm. I wish I personally liked it more, or at least found it more rewatchable, because it's so rich with meaning. But with the exception of the last 30 minutes or so, I find it a little dull, and the word overkill comes to mind.
Would you put it on your own top 100 tops or not?
No, no, definitely not. While I don't like it, I respect it a lot. And I agree with Pauline Kael. I think it has some character problems, mostly that Deckard is both unlikable and, I don't know, he just doesn't interest me. Roy Batty, great character. Mm-hmm. Once he's really the focus, then I get into the movie. But Deckard, as a character, does nothing for me.
Dustin Hoffman could have had this role and turned it down. Maybe he saw that kind of future in the role. Instead, he was in Tootsie the same year, and that character's got all kinds of life and juice. Neither one of them made it, but Deckard and Batty were nominated for the Heroes and Villains list. And guess who was the hero and guess who was the villain? Batty's not really a villain. All he wants to do is live. He kills people. In fact, he gives Tyrell, Joe Turkel, who we've seen in The Shining. We covered that in the Not 100 Project, and it was also in Paths of Glory. He gives him the Prince Oberyn death from Game of Thrones. And if you've seen that show from last year, I think it was the second to last episode of last season, I have never seen that again on YouTube. I've never seen the episode a second time, and I never need to see it again. It's still very vivid in my mind.
Eyes are such a visceral thing, mm-hmm. aren't they?
That was more realistic than this one is, although it's quite well done in 1982. But it's clearly just a dummy, a model that they're using to squash the fake eyes out of.
They get a lot of mileage out of the sound effects they use, too.
Yeah, having the guy scream in horror.
Yeah, it's pretty
cool. But apart from a few moments like that, yes, he kills people. I'm not excusing that. But as far as the character you want to watch on screen, Deckard isn't likable. Deckard is hard even really to want to root for because he is out trying to kill other things, even though they aren't.
And when he finds, say, Zora, she's not causing any harm. She's mm-hmm. not doing anything wrong. She actually seems like the one replicant that's just tried to get a job and pass and get on with her life. Mm-hmm. But he hunts her down and kills her. And you do see him go buy a bottle of liquor to calm his nerves. But he's also a real jerk to Rachel, who is a very vulnerable character in a vulnerable mm-hmm. position. The way that he confirms to her that she is a replicant is downright mean. He's just naming these personal memories of hers that she has. There's nothing delicate or careful about it. And then their love scene is like Rocky, where you're
like, this one's more vicious.
Consent is ultimately given, but there's definitely a gray area for a large part of the scene, and he's being a jerk.
But she's not a person. She's like his toaster.
Or is she? She's no toaster. It's not like they have metal skeletons. It's not like it's circuitry in their brains. They are genetically engineered.
And it's curious to think that whatever is inside them, let's say there's got to be some kind of fake non-human things in there. There must be some kind of stuff like that. Terrell's scientific genius went into this. The money, the time, the effort. And all you do is put holes in these things when they come back to Earth, when they just want to live, although Batty and Leon do kill people, but nevertheless.
I mean, it's a silly little point to pick on. The four-year lifespan, shouldn't these things cost a lot of money to mm-hmm. produce? Why would you ever make a replicant only live 4 years? One of the most interesting kind of revelations about 12 Years a Slave, they talk a great deal about how valuable a slave is, that you want to keep them alive.
And which is why they don't just off them whenever they talk back.
Right, right. And it's the same with these, where it's like, why would you give it a four-year lifespan? They're so expensive to make and presumably valuable.
Is Deckard a replicant?
Ridley Scott says yes.
He thinks people are stupid if they don't see that Deckard is a replicant.
There's all the different versions of the movie, so I guess there's debate, and there's people who worked on the movie who debated Harrison Ford, notably one of the writers.
Ford was flat out against it. Rutger Hauer also was. And yet there's this running motif of the red eyes with all the replicants. At one point or another, we see their eyes glow red. Maybe that's an homage to Terminator because the machines in that movie also have red eyes. And Deckard, in one scene in his apartment, it's just a light from outside shining in his eyes. But the bigger evidence would be the unicorn dream.
Oh, yeah.
Or daydream, as you point out. He's not actually sleeping.
No.
He's just tinkling on a piano, and we see this unicorn running across a field. And that was the subject in Ridley Scott's next movie, Legend. There's unicorns in that film. And at the very end, Gaff leaves the origami that is a unicorn, as if to say, I know what you're thinking because you're not human.
It's a stretch that Gaff would be an individual who's privy to the memories of replicants.
Well, he could access it. He's a cop.
Yeah.
Bryant, the M. Emmett Walsh character, could have very easily told him.
Yeah, and then I guess he would leave that as a warning to Deckard to say, hey, we're going to come for you next, because he's on the run with Sean Young now.
We even meet him in weird circumstances. He's a retired Blade Runner, effectively a PI. You called him a bounty hunter earlier. But what was he doing before that? Okay, obviously he must have killed other replicants. But he doesn't seem to ever refer to his past except for that part of it. It's almost like he just sprung out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. The replicants treat each other like family. We've already talked about whether or not Batty is a villain. But if you look at the way Batty treats his fellow replicants, it's much kinder than we see any of the humans treat each other. The humans have this great hypocrisy where they test the replicants for empathy, and they administer that test by asking them questions about animals, and yet you never see any live animals. You only see the synthetic owl, the synthetic snake. They've destroyed the environment. They treat the poor like dirt.
Some of those things are happening already, not in the future.
Oh, yeah.
Not in fantasy.
That is that is possibly a prophetic part of this film, that the gap between the rich and the poor, definitely very well drawn in this film.
And a
film.
Future that must really bother you, that there are no real animals anywhere.
Why live? Send me off-world if I can't have my creatures around me all the time.
So are we just the sum of our memories as human beings anyway? If you woke up with amnesia, didn't know anything about yourself, okay, you're still a human being, but your old life is gone. If you could never get it back again, are you really you?
I think an even more interesting point is the tragedy that all those memories die with us.
Mm-hmm.
That mortality
like
means...
Like tears in the rain.
Like tears in the rain. What an amazing speech. I watched it again on YouTube after we saw the movie. It's so beautiful.
And Rutger Hauer wrote that.
Yeah, incredible.
He describes things I wish we could see in this movie. Battleships on fire out in space, all kinds of crazy stuff. And he's saying to Deckard, possibly a fellow replicant, possibly not, you wouldn't believe the things I've seen. They're all just going to fade away and be gone.
It's really not a very long speech. But it's such a succinct and beautiful way to express the true tragedy that is mortality in general.
So in that final sequence, maybe the last 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, when we finally see Deckard and Batty go head to head, if Deckard is a replicant, he is outmatched by Batty. Now, Batty's probably stronger than all the other replicants. Okay, he's a super replicant, fine.
He was a soldier replicant, that was his job.
But still, he really, truly outmatches Deckard. They both bleed. Batty deliberately stabs himself in the hand with a nail, and he bleeds, and he shows pain as he pushes it through. His own version of stigmata. It's also artificial adrenaline to keep him going. He must know his time is coming very quickly. Incidentally, if Deckard had just stayed away, Batty would have just broke down. He didn't have to go through any of that pain and near death. I don't think you even answered that question. Do you think he's a replicant?
I don't think the movie really sells it properly, if he is.
They want it to be ambiguous.
And I know Ridley Scott, in his mind, he is. Details like that, they really do make it a stretch. I think ambiguity is key because the whole point of the film is to make us all turn around and question our own mortality and what makes us human. That's really what the film is all about. What is humanity? What makes us better or more valuable as creatures, as consciousnesses? Is that a word? Than replicants, if replicants existed. Nothing, really.
And this is yet another AFI allegory for racism. LA in the future is very integrated. There's all kinds of different types of people. Most of the characters we care about are white, okay, granted.
Most of the wealthy characters are white. All the people in their little castles, white.
Which was true in 82, and it certainly is true now. Which was true when the book was written in 68. The book by Philip K. Dick, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The replicant and Blade Runner stuff, incidentally, has nothing to do with the book. They were called androids in the book, never replicant. And then Blade Runner comes from an Alan Norse book about illegally selling surgical instruments. And Ridley Scott just liked the term Blade Runner and said, let's go with that.
It is a cool term.
It does have a cool name to it. The movie could have been called all kinds of things. A lot of movies have different titles. In the offing, this was almost Dangerous Days, which is what they call the extremely long making of documentary, which I've only ever watched once. It is too long to watch again until I get one hell of a big sick day at some point in the future, I guess. It was even going to be called Gotham City, and that comes around nicely to Christopher Nolan, who's so inspired by these movies, and who made the Batman movies a few years ago based on Blade Runner's look. And the movie was called Blood Runner by the crew because Ridley Scott worked them so hard. There's also a famous saying by an old cowboy actor, Will Rogers. He never met a man he didn't like. And I guess the crew had shirts printed up that said, Will Rogers never met Ridley Scott. And he had all kinds of trouble with his crew on this one. That's part of the whole Dangerous Days thing. They talk about how tough the crew was to work with. And ironically, it's an Englishman working in America. And I mentioned Terminator a few minutes ago. When James Cameron, who made that movie, went to England to do Aliens, he had a hell of a hard time with the crew, who were English.
See, I always understood that in England, crews really work 9 to 5 days. They actually wrap it up after 8 hours. And American crews are the ones that work around the clock that have those crazy, long, long 18-hour days.
Maybe Ridley Scott saying, I'm over in Hollywood now, I can do whatever I want to, because back home I could never do this.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the race stuff, the race relations. The replicants are superior in every way to their creators and masters, but they're made for slaves. You mentioned 12 Years a Slave a few minutes ago. This is a great example of that. Chiwetel Ejiofor's character mentally has all kinds of things going for him. He's a very smart guy. He's extremely talented on the violin. He's a compassionate person. He has all the qualities you'd want from anybody to be a leader of society, and yet he's treated like nothing. Not that any of them should have been treated like that, of course, but part of the point in that movie, one of the weaknesses some people have pointed out, is that this guy should not be put in a slave camp, and of course no one should be, period. But it's even more outrageous, and that's why movies like 12 Years a Slave and the secondary part of this movie is, you have Roy Batty doing slave work. This guy should be doing something way more important than off-world nothing, and building stuff, and then coming back to Earth and getting killed for it.
And how can you possibly root against slaves becoming free, which is what they're trying to do? And what does he say when he's hanging off the building?
Now you know what it's like to live in fear, something like that.
Yeah, now you know what it's like to be a slave. Mm-hmm. You could make this movie from their point of view and make them 100% sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But I think that's exactly what Scott wanted to do.
And in that scene where Ford's hanging off the side of the building, we've seen this in making ofs many times. If you watch this kind of stuff, behind the scenes documentaries type thing. Ford's just laying on the ground, and the camera's on the side, and there's a rear projection, or maybe even front projection screen off in the distance, and it looks like he's hanging off of there. When he loses his grip with one hand, he should be swinging.
Yeah.
The way gravity will make you do that, he should almost fall off. He's also got a ruined hand. He's got two or three broken fingers when Batty just decides to break them on him just for the sake of it. Well, he does do it because Deckard killed his friends.
He's toying with Deckard. He could kill Deckard. He has him dead to rights several times. Mm. He really does ultimately choose to let Deckard live. Mm. He's just kind of having fun torturing him to get revenge for his friends.
I mentioned the narration earlier on, and people who like this movie for the most part don't like that. Harrison Ford didn't want to do it, and then they say that he read it badly on purpose. He says, I did to the best of my ability. He had a real problem with Bud Yorkin and Jerry Parenchino, two of the many producers on this film that made him do it. Ridley Scott certainly didn't want narration in there. But the reason I bring that up now is because one of the key things in that narration that does get lost, his gumshoe 40s film noir kind of narration, includes a line about how he watched Batty die all night long.
Oh.
And we don't get that from what we see in the movie. He seems like he dies not long after, in fact, very soon after the Tears and Rain speech when the dove flies off.
The dove. When I said earlier there's some overkill in this movie, the dove is a really good example.
That was Rutger Hauer's idea, too.
Oh my God, come on. First of all, where'd the perfect pure white dove come from? It's just in his hand at one point. Like, where did you get that? And then he jumps from building to building with the dove in his hand, holds it that whole time as he's giving that speech, and then lets it go at that perfect moment.
Well, perfect moment because he's died. He's losing his grip like anyone would, or any creature would.
Yes, anybody who's dying lets go of their perfect pure white dove as they breathe their last breaths. There was a couple moments where I'm like, that's dumb. She's wearing an enormous fur coat in the pouring rain.
She being Rachel you're talking about.
Rachel, yeah. There's so many great ambient scenes that display the beautiful production design.
Well, the detail is remarkable.
Some of the details are dumb. Why are there roving gangs of little people?
A lot of midgets in this movie.
There's not that many little people in the world, and I don't think they all band together and make street gangs. 2019 is still 4 years away, but
there's a lot of cliches in this film. The one last job thing. He's unretired to go on one last job. The hunter becomes the hunted, and the end sequence when Deckard is the one who actually is being tracked by Batty and could easily be killed. And then even the zoom and enhance thing, we see that so often in modern movies with cameras and all that kind of thing. Zoom in on that and get a closer look. Rather than being all pixelated and distorted, it looks better and better, and that's when he's looking at the photograph.
They really make us watch him zoom in on a lot of random details before he finally gets to the point in that particular scene.
To finally see Zora in the background. But back to details. They use a lot of great miniatures, bigatures, if you will. Peter Jackson called them that in Lord of the Rings. I don't know if he coined that phrase, but I remember in the appendices of the making of the Lord of the Rings movies, he called them bigatures. Star Wars, of course, had a lot of great miniatures, too. Douglas Trumbull was one of the guys involved. Sid Mead was an artist. These guys did not win the Oscar, and E.T. was a worthy choice. Blade Runner was the better choice.
Mm.
It should have won the Oscar for special effects. Now, maybe they didn't look as good in the original version. We watched the final cut, the only version that's on the Blu-ray. I bought the DVD that has, I think, four versions of this movie. There's the work print, there's the final cut, there's the original version, there's the director's cut. I guess that's the four. Jesus, make one movie and stick with it. But the final cut's the one I'd rather see. I've seen the director's cut on DVD a couple of times, and now this version, I think, three times. We'll stick with that from this point on. Well, we're probably not going to watch the movie again, but anyway. It does look unbelievable. It's a great Blu-ray. It's so well cleaned up. Another terrific remastering job. And then you do see the Trumbull and Mead and Ridley Scott and everybody else involved. Their work just shines and pops and it's great. Although one of the things that people point out about the look, is that so much of it is about marketing. We see ads everywhere. And so many of the brands that are in this movie either don't exist anymore or had financial hard times. Coke brought in new Coke, struggled. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they recovered. They're still a powerhouse to this day. But TDK, I believe, is in there. I don't know if they exist anymore. Pan Am does not exist anymore. They're long gone. Atari certainly doesn't exist as a gaming system that I loved when I was a kid. Around this age, in fact, I had one. I still have it somewhere in this house.
It's a great counter to the Reese's Pieces story from E.T., being in that movie helped its business, but it is quite possible that appearing in Blade Runner was probably not good for your brand, because it's really a criticism of corporate America, and it makes those ads look insidious and intrusive. Another overkill thing would be the constant spotlights coming through the window and the dirigibles.
It is a police state, and the dirigibles are out there to watch people at all times. I don't think that's overkill. That's something we might be heading to in the future, although we have so many cameras around. We don't really need anybody hovering above us, shining lights and cameras into our apartments and our condos and our houses to see what we're doing. There's so many cameras everywhere already, but same basic idea. Big Brother is a theme in this movie, too.
But as much as he was presenting that corporate ubiquity, it's so much worse than even what's portrayed in that movie. Now, living in a big city, you walk around at night and there are parts of this city where it looks like it's daytime because the lights are so bright and the billboards are everywhere.
Our version of Times Square is Young and Dundas. And it's just like that. And we've talked about Times Square a few times in this podcast in the New York movies about how it may not be a cesspool anymore that's in Taxi Driver, for example.
It's a different kind of cesspool.
It's just nothing but ads. It is Blade Runner reborn. In addition to the dirigibles are the spinners, the flying cars. Nice little precursor to the flying DeLorean in the Back to the Future sequence.
I want to know if in 2019 we get to find out what kind of pill that geisha is taking that makes her so happy in that billboard.
Female Viagra.
Oh, maybe that's it. That would put a
Lady
smile
boners
on your face.
Lady boners are in.
So the production design is probably one of the most influential things about Blade Runner.
It is the most influential thing.
Period, right? And it didn't just influence the look of films from here on in, and not just a handful of films.
It influenced real places.
Like what?
Well, I think Times Square and parts of Tokyo, and as we mentioned, Young and Dundas here in Toronto, have been influenced by the look of this film. Not the constant oppression and the rain and the dark and night.
I don't know if they would have intended, if they would have gone out with the intention of resembling this dystopia.
One of the reasons the movie's almost always at night is because that's the whole film noir thing. You track through the mean streets at nighttime, it's just way more effective. The Batman movies are pretty similar. You almost always see Batman only when it's dark. So that's a thematic device. Obviously, there's going to be some sunshine and some daylight, or else they wouldn't be able to live.
So you got the Batman movies, you've got Ghost in the Shell, a lot of Terry Gilliam stuff, starting with Brazil that came out only a couple of years after this.
Another failure at the box office in a big way. Although the remastered director's cut is beloved by so many people now, if that had been released in 85, maybe it would have been a big success to begin with. Or at least it wouldn't have been such a fight for Gilliam to get it made with the studio.
And he's another director that likes to put little people in his movies. If anyone's ever seen the first movie that Peter Dinklage was ever in, it's called Living in Oblivion, and he has this brilliant speech about the way filmmakers use little people that sums it up. Have any of you ever had a dream about a midget? Any of you? Brazil very much shares Blade Runner's vision of the future. 12 Monkeys is another great example, where it's so futuristic, but you say futuristic, but it's almost an alternate reality. It's so extreme that you feel like he's not really even trying to pretend this is where we might be going. It's an exaggeration
of a fictional story.
But it's an exaggeration of criticisms he has of where he sees society going. The book Neuromancer, have you ever read Neuromancer?
Yeah.
Neuromancer and Blade Runner are collectively credited with creating the cyberpunk genre. It would be kind of that mixture of the sleek future and the filthy future that you see, but with lots of those exaggerated elements like the architecture, which is great. That big pyramid, that big Mayan pyramid that the Tyrells
in,
the apartment that Deckard lives in. You know, there's the textured detail work on the inside of his apartment.
Okay.
That was copied directly from the Mayan temples in Mexico. That building where his apartment is actually a really famous Frank Lloyd Wright building in L.A. And Frank Lloyd Wright was inspired by those Mayan temples. That's apparently one of the other clues that he's a replicant, because the design of his apartment is mimicked in the Tyrell building.
And he lives on the 97th floor, too. His apartment number is 9732. He's way up there.
Yeah, it's all vertical. That's another thing in the future. It's all skyscrapers. And that's another representation of the hierarchy. The rich and the poor. The poor live on the bottom, where everything is very wet and leaky. And foggy for LA as well, although that could be smog.
It's basically just a futuristic hell. No one really seems happy, even the people that have money, like Tyrell, for example. The building where Batty and Deckard have their big battle at the end, the Bradbury, I wonder if that's an homage to Ray Bradbury, the science fiction writer.
Oh, yeah, very well could be.
I should have looked this up, but I'm not sure if the Bradbury is an actual building in LA. But there are some great sequences set in there, of course, at the end. And one more thing about the end sequence, when Batty expires, he has the only natural death of the replicants that we see in the film. Yeah. Well, Rachel maybe will, but and if Deckard is a replicant as well, maybe he will. Of the four, Leon, Pris, Batty, and Zora, the other three are shot.
And he just expires.
Mm-hmm. So he just fades away like tears and rain. And the very end, when Deckard and Rachel go down that elevator, it's a Maltese Falcon kind of ending.
Mm-hmm.
Gaff, Edward James Olmos's character, is kind of like Ward Bond in the Maltese Falcon. Mary Astor goes on the elevator. She's going to her doom. And Rachel's a doomed femme fatale of her own. The only difference is Deckard's with her. He's not sending her off to the gallows the way that Bogart is in the Maltese Falcon.
Maybe another hint that he is also doomed.
Yeah, that could be. All right, Harrison Ford, his final of five AFI films. He could have been an E.T. last week. We said that then. Mr. Assassin in this movie. For all intents and purposes, he is just an assassin. I mentioned Dustin Hoffman could have had the role. Robert Mitchum was another good choice, and I love that guy. He would have been terrific in this film. And the usual suspects were also talked about, including Arnold, Al Pacino, and Peter Falk. Who would have been a fun one, Mr. Glass Eye. One more thing before I shoot you. All Deckard is missing to be a true noir hero, is the hat. But he wouldn't wear a hat because of Raiders just the previous year. And probably a smart move to differentiate between the two characters. I heard Nicholson was never going to take a PI role after he did Jake Gittes in Chinatown. That was our last LA set film on the Top Number Project, actually. Yeah. It's been quite a while since we had one set there. And Nicholson wouldn't play a PI because he wanted to set it aside for Jake Gittes. He only played it one more time in The Two Jakes.
So what do you think of Harrison Ford as Deckard? I have misgivings about his casting.
One thing I'll say is this five AFI films, American Graffiti, Star Wars, Apocalypse Now, Raiders, and now this. All different kinds of roles, with the exception of George Lucas, he worked with different directors four times, and all different kinds of people, too. Spielberg and Scott and Coppola and Lucas, all very different kinds of people, although three of those guys are buddies. The role calls for little emotion. It calls for a guy not to be noticing the effects around him, as Roger Ebert said about him in the Indiana Jones films, or any other big budget special effects kind of movie he's been in. He just seems to fit naturally in there. He was great as the 1930s-esque hero, although he's stealing stuff out of graves. So again, debatably as a hero, really. And he's pretty believable as a futuristic guy, too. He does play this disaffected PI kind of character, I think, quite well for what the script calls for. But he doesn't really do anything in the role either, whether that was called for or not. So my long-winded answer for your question, he's fine, but the character has no life in the first place. I don't know if Hoffman or Mitchum or Arnold or Pacino or anyone else could have done any better than he did.
I kind of tried to imagine if they had cast a tough guy, if they had cast a Clint Eastwood or something in that role. But then you would lose the vulnerability, especially at the end when he really is at Batty's mercy for a long time. And I think part of what he's doing is experiencing pain. Scott said this was a masochistic film. He made it immediately after he watched his brother die a rather painful death of skin cancer. And that Tears in the Rain speech, his older brother was a merchant marine and saw the world. He actually had all these experiences that died with him when he died a rather premature death. And so that's why Ridley Scott had to make this extremely personal film, searching, trying to find the answers about mortality and explore the true tragedy of it. So I can see why you want Harrison Ford's vulnerability. He can kind of express that, but at the same time, he's holding it back because he's playing this hard-boiled...
Private eye kind of character.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm saying, yeah. And whether or not he was ever a fan of this film, well, I guess he is more so now. He talks in that Dangerous Days documentary about how he's okay with things for the most part now. But he did disagree with Scott pretty harshly, and then he was pissed at the producers for making him do that narration in the first place. So his experience on this was not great.
He said, "What I remember more than anything else when I see Blade Runner is not the 50 nights of shooting in the rain, but the voiceover. I was still obliged to work for these clowns that came in writing one bad voiceover after another."
And that was Yorkin and Parencino I mentioned before. His femme fatale, Sean Young, was also on Wall Street, as was Daryl Hannah, who plays Pris. And I guess the most famous story about her, apart from Blade Runner, is that she stalked Tim Burton while trying to be Catwoman in Batman Returns. She was going to be Vicki Vale in the first Batman movie, but then lost the role to an injury, I think it was. She broke her leg or something when they were doing a horseback riding sequence that didn't even make the final cut anyway with Kim Basinger. And I guess she said, well, I'm Catwoman for sure then, even though really she wasn't the right choice for that. Annette Bening was supposed to have been Catwoman, but then she got pregnant with Warren Beatty's kid, and they got Michelle Pfeiffer instead. And I watched Batman Returns again only a few weeks ago, and she still is the best thing in that film.
She's the best thing in so many films.
She is Michelle Pfeiffer. And I think maybe the reason why Sean Young's credits are not really all that great apart from this, and Wall Street's a pretty good movie, she probably has alienated people by being a little nuts. She seems to be. I've heard a few stories. And I've never, ever heard anybody call Harrison Ford Harry, except for her in that Dangerous Days documentary on the DVD and Blu-ray. The antagonist, villain, hero, whatever he may be, Rutger Hauer, he'd been in Nighthawks before this in another great villain role. Well, that was actually a villain role for sure. And then Lady Hawk and The Hitcher after it. Not a lot of other great credits in his entire career, except for those four movies in the 80s. But this is a defining role for anybody. We don't even see him until 25 minutes in the movie, except maybe debatably the eyes in the very beginning when we see that skyline shot with all the fire coming out of the stacks, and they cut to some eyes for a minute.
I think it's supposed to be his eyes, yeah.
Because they've landed on Earth, and that's what he sees first, I guess.
Eyes are a massive theme. Visually, it's all over the place. It starts with that beautiful eye surveying all of LA. All the replicants have the reflective eyes. The test that determines whether the replicants or not.
Which is called what? What is the name of that test?
I have it written down.
Oh, she'll get it.
It's a Voight-Kampff machine, and I don't know why.
Maybe John Voight's homage there.
Maybe the designers...
I know, John Voight and Mein Kampf.
Oh.
Hitler's book.
I don't think that's right.
Okay, well, so back to the eyes.
When he's looking for Tyrell, when he wants to find out how to extend his life, he goes to the person who designed his eyes. Mm-hmm.
He kills Tyrell by squashing his eyes in that Prince Oberyn Game of Thrones death I mentioned a few minutes ago. It is a recurring theme. And then even the tears and rain. Where do tears come from? Your eyes.
So Rutger Hauer, Ridley Scott had seen him in several Paul Verhoeven's films. Paul Verhoeven's Dutch, right?
I think he's Dutch.
Yes, yeah. Dutch films. And I guess Hauer was a pretty famous actor in Holland. And he said that he was his first and only choice, that he was perfect. Just the Aryan, severe face of his. And he is... perfect.
And his build, too.
Oh, yeah. He's hands down the best thing in the movie.
And he's vicious but merciful. Daryl Hannah has a very small role as Pris. She was in Splash 2 years later. And then Kill Bill.
Yes.
She's had a long career and not a lot of other great roles, but that's a pretty interesting foursome right there. Blade Runner, Splash, Wall Street, and then Kill Bill.
And she's a tremendous physical actress. Her physical performance in this film, the acrobatics that she does,
She doesn't do the acrobatics.
Oh, damn it!
That's a gymnast. And the story on that one is that it was a female gymnast, first of all, but they did so many takes, Ridley Scott blood-runnered her so much that they had to get a male gymnast to come in and do the flippy-flippy and then landing on Harrison Ford and squashing him. That may have been a woman that did that part of it, but the gymnastics sequence, the boop-boop-boop-boop, was a guy. Daryl Hannah did some of it. I guess she did have Harrison Ford between her legs at one point and easily could have killed him, then gets shot, and then has that death where she's throwing a tantrum, essentially, which is reprised in Kill Bill Part 2 when she loses her eye.
Oh, my God. All the connections.
How about those connections? Brian James is Leon, the guy who gets mad about talking about his mother in the beginning, and who wouldn't shoot somebody who's asking questions about your mother after all? He had a long career despite dying at 54, so he was not very old at all. And he was also another sci-fi pseudo-classic. A lot of people love this one. The Fifth Element, design-wise at least, is outstanding. I'm not a big fan of the story on that one any more than this one, but another brilliantly designed film. Edward James Olmos, who delivers that city speak. At times, you don't know what the hell he's even saying. I guess that's the point. It's futuristic slang. There's lots of slang now that people wouldn't understand from the 40s if they were to be alive in 2015 in L.A. He's mostly done TV stuff over the many years of his career. Battlestar Galactica, which is definitely influenced by this movie, that TV show, the new version, not the old version. And then his best film role, other than Blade Runner, would be Stand and Deliver, which he did in the late 80s with Lou Diamond Phillips.
And I think he was the chief in Miami Vice.
Another TV role then. M. Emmett Walsh, the big cop, was in the business for 45 plus years. He was actually uncredited in Midnight Cowboy, so one of the few members of the supporting cast that was in any other AFI film. I think he was on the bus at the end of that movie. And his most famous role, without a doubt, is in Blood Simple 2 years after this one. Just like Daryl Hannah's most famous role would be 2 years after, 1984, in Splash. Well, Blood Simple, Walsh is fantastic in that movie. And the other actor we got to mention is William Sanderson, who is J.F. Sebastian. Another guy who did mostly TV. He was the sheriff on True Blood. If people are fans of that show, they're going to know him from that one. I've never seen that. Nor have I ever seen Deadwood or Newhart. Other two major roles for him. The Newhart thing would be where he's Larry. This is my brother Daryl.
Yep.
And my other brother Daryl. He's a pretty key role. He's tied into the replicants. And he is in the Bradbury where the climax takes place.
He's sweet. I like him.
When we first meet Pris and we first meet him, what is she doing? She's laying down in garbage to sleep. She's got nowhere else to go.
I thought she was just waiting for him specifically.
Well, she played it as if she had nowhere else to go, at least. Maybe you're right about that.
Yeah.
But again, these are super beings and they're resorting to that. Kind of sad. All right, Ridley Scott's only got one AFI film. He also did Alien, Gladiator, Black Hawk Down, some big hits in there. He was actually planning to do Dune instead of this, as was Alejandro Jodorowsky, I think is his name. There's a documentary on Netflix, Jodorowsky, am I pronouncing that right? But his Dune, watch it if you like movies about movies. Could have presaged Star Wars and Blade Runner and many other sci-fi films, but it never got made at all. And it might have been brilliant. We talked about the battles he had with the crew and with Harrison Ford so much. And he never did work with any of these people again, at least not Ford in a starring role. But they did make up, at least, eventually. So, direction, what'd you think of it?
I'm not a Ridley Scott fan.
Too cold for you?
I've just never loved any of his films. I've liked a couple of his films. Earlier this week, I watched the trailer for The Martian. Mm-hmm. And I said to you, I can't decide if this is going to be a movie I should watch or not, because it has all these things that I should like, but all these things that I often hate. You asked who directed it. I looked it up. So Ridley Scott. I was like, oh, that settles it. I'm not going to bother. But when I was doing the research for Blade Runner and learned all about how Blade Runner was about his brother's death, and he made this great film about grief, and then I thought, an individual trapped on a planet far away who needs your help, but you can't get to him to save his life, which is the premise for The Martian, could be a great, beautiful metaphor for depression and the brother that he lost just recently, Tony Scott.
Right.
And that made me really curious about the movie.
And Tony Scott killed himself. It wasn't that he died of some horrible disease. So Ridley Scott must have had that thought that I think anyone would, which is, I wish I could have helped him. Why couldn't I have saved him somehow?
Because suffering from depression can be like being stranded on a mm-hmm. planet by yourself. So I'm quite curious about that. But, you know, if the reviews are bad, I'll skip it.
A movie yet to come. Let's get back to the movie that already happened, Blade Runner. The writers, Hampton Fancher and David Peoples. Fancher doesn't have a lot of big credits, but David Peoples has three great ones. The other two, Unforgiven, another AFI film, and then 12 Monkeys, which I love so much. I know you're not a big fan of that one, but that guy was involved in three tremendous films. One, a Western, has nothing to do with Blade Runner and 12 Monkeys, but the other two, obviously, sci-fi themed. We talked about Philip K. Dick writing the book that this is based on. He died in early 82, but he did see a print. He didn't like it at first. He trashed it, in fact. Then later on, he changed his mind, and he felt they nailed it, that they got his vision just right. Although Ridley Scott and David Peoples, neither of them even read his book.
Oh my God, really?
That's what I read.
So speaking of grief being a theme in this film, Philip K. Dick lost a twin sister as an infant, and as a result, a lot of his work has themes about doppelgangers or phantom twins and kindred spirits. So maybe that's what attracted Scott to the premise in the first place.
Minority Report is a movie I like a lot. Mm. It's definitely influenced by this one. And in that, Tom Cruise's character has lost his son.
That's right.
And does not know what happened to him.
It's not a perfect film, but it has one of the best prophetic visions of the future.
Mm-hmm. All right, the producers of Blade Runner. The main one is Michael Dealy, who was involved in The Deer Hunter, and he's involved in a few other kinds of films with his production company. And speaking of production companies, Alan Ladd Jr., who is the guy who greenlit Star Wars at Fox when no one else wanted to make that movie, he had started the Ladd Company by this point. He was involved in a lot of good movies, including Chariots of Fire a few years before this, the composer Vangelis, or actually I was reading Vangelis just today, whatever his name actually is, was a composer on that one too. And Laddie is probably one of the reasons this movie got made in the first place. I mentioned Warner Brothers released it. Columbia Pictures was involved too. All right, so the 2.35:1 Blu-ray, we talked about how good it looked, and we did watch the final cut, so we recommend that. We can't really speak about the work print. We're never going to watch it. For those who are completists, they're going to watch all 483 hours of footage that are on that DVD. And if there is a Blu-ray out there that has all that stuff, then more power to you, but I'm not watching all that stuff. The documentary was good. I do recommend that. The cinematographer, Jordan Cronenweth, he had Parkinson's. It didn't work too much longer after this movie. He also shot Peggy Sue Got Married for Francis Ford Coppola, his only Oscar nomination for cinematography, in fact. And he operated on Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid way back when, the only other AFI involvement for him. And his son, his name eludes me at the moment, became a cinematographer also. The editor, Terry Rawlings, had worked on Alien with Ridley Scott before. This could have been an AFI film, really. That had to have been close to making the top 100. And he also cut Chariots of Fire. We're mentioning that more and more as we move along through the credits here. Marcia Nakashima was his co-editor, and this was her only ever movie. The composer, Vangelis, however you pronounce it, Chariots of Fire. Everyone knows that score, the most famous thing he ever did. Oh, this score, that tech-noir kind of sound.
So different.
And that tech-noir thing I just said, I mentioned that line before. That's a bar in The Terminator. Tech-noir really applies to these kinds of movies, I think. Because noir referencing the 40s kinds of film noir. People are out on a hunt for something, but then it's modern, so it's the technology involved in there.
There's something so appealing about that genre. It never goes away.
Minority Report has that kind of thing, too. It's also about a guy on a hunt for the truth.
Definitely. What do you think of the score?
I get why people love this score. Also, the Basil Poladour score from Conan the Barbarian in 82, the same year. And, of course, John Williams did E.T. this same year. So some very famous music came from this one year. I've never listened to it on its own. It certainly fits the movie.
Definitely. It's a little dated, but it's really
as thematic. Is the Terminator score. The Terminator score 2 years later. Worse. Mentioning it yet again. Some of the themes became so iconic from that. And then some of the other music that's in the Terminator. That isn't dated, but a lot of the other stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not a fan of music score in the first place, so I'm sure you're not a huge fan of this one.
I like that it's different, and for what it is, it really works. Unfortunately, anything with synthesizer in the 80s just screams 80s. It was maybe a little too early to really use that as an instrument and not expect it to timestamp your film forever, but it's just going to be a number of decades before that stops sounding campy and just starts sounding classic.
We talked about Douglas Trumbull and Sid Mead, who were two of the guys involved in the effects in this movie. Outstanding work. Trumbull, let's not forget, worked on 2001 and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So no more AFI films for him, but that's a pretty good threesome of sci-fi flicks right there. Okay, you, Bev, already talked about the influence, but let's name a few more. Metropolis, the movie from the mid-20s, the German film by Fritz Lang, definitely influenced Blade Runner. So did The Frankenstein Story.
Oh, yeah.
And then film noir in general.
Metropolis, to the extent that the guy who built the miniatures used Metropolis as its guide.
You covered so many of the influences for me already. I'm only going to say a couple more here. The multiple versions of this film had already been done before. Close Encounters of the Third Kind is probably the most noteworthy example of a movie that got a director's cut not long after it came out because Spielberg had the money and the clout to do that. Well, we talked about Ridley Scott getting to redo this, and I think it was 92. I think it was 10 years later that he came out with the director's cut that almost everybody seems to prefer. But this one's more controversial because of so many things that changed about it. The last influence is there's an upcoming sequel. They are going to make it, they say. Denis Villeneuve, the Canadian director, he's going to get the job. Ridley Scott will produce but not direct. Villeneuve is the guy who did Incendie, a painful but awesome French film that we've only seen once.
The first film that you and I saw as a couple in the movie theater.
And also in the TIFF Bell Lightbox, which was still new at the time.
Yeah.
Great place to see a movie. Villeneuve also did Prisoners a few years ago and Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal just last year, I believe that was. So he's got a very interesting filmography. Okay, there's not a huge amount of AFI lists and awards, but here we go. It only had 2 Oscar nominations. That's fewer than we've had in quite a while, just for the visual effects and those sets. Should have won both of them, without a doubt. This is the first movie we've covered in quite a long time not to win any Oscars. The first, in fact, since Taxi Driver in 1976. Also should have won something. Congress put Blade Runner in the National Film Registry in 1993. If I've never mentioned this before, it takes 10 years before a movie can get into that.
Oh.
So sometimes we say it took a while for a movie to get in there. Well, it couldn't have made it until 1992 anyway.
How about that?
Blade Runner is 74th on the Top 100 Throws list and 6th in the sci-fi category of the Top 100 Genres. A lot of great titles in the sci-fi category. Of the genres list, various nominations that didn't make it, maybe all, or at least some of these should have. Batty's Tears and Rain, Time to Die speech was nominated for the Top 100 Quotes. Another quote that probably should have made that list.
Mm-hmm.
And then I mentioned before, Deckard is a top 50 hero and Batty is a top 50 villain. Those are extremely debatable, but the top 25 music scorers maybe had a shot at making it, but did not. Okay, let's wrap here. Your last thoughts about Blade Runner, and I'll ask you this question to set it up. 97th on the second list, didn't make the first one. Influence alone gets this movie on the top of her list, whether we like it or not. But what do you think?
It may not be perfect or right up my alley, but it is impossible to deny that Blade Runner is an important and influential film. How could it be this low on the list when it's such a massive, massive part of culture? I think there's definitely a debate to be had for its value.
The Shawshank Redemption will cover. I was glad to see the movie made the second list. And as much as I and so many other people love that movie, I don't know that it has a lot of influence. It wasn't successful. It didn't win a lot of awards. It should have made it. I'm glad for that just because it's a great movie. A lot
sheer
of movies
popularity.
That made, yeah. And maybe that's the main reason it did make it. It also was pretty highly ranked. And this one's quite lowly ranked considering that.
People love Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college, I just remember being a given that every person in film school was a Blade Runner fan.
And when the second show was on 2007, my thoughts were a few films had to make it the second time around because I knew they were going to have some different ones. And when this was in the first block of movies at 97th, I thought, wow, at least it's on there, but 97th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's enough out of us about Blade Runner. We're off next week to enjoy some Canada Day fun and sun. If you miss us terribly, check out the Canadian special we posted last year. We'll put it up on the site and the front page to make sure people know it's there. When we return on July 6th, we've got Dustin Hoffman's final AFI flick. We talked about Harrison Ford's diversity. Hoffman's movies are very different, too. It's the cross-dressing comic romp, Tootsie. The coming attractions trivia for Tootsie. It was a monster hit, the 66th biggest ever when adjusted for inflation. We've talked about the Box Office Mojo Top 200 many times. What are the other 4 Dustin Hoffman movies, AFI or not, on Box Office Mojo's top 200 adjusted for inflation?
Good question. All right, for the answer to that, please tune into our Tootsie podcast 2 weeks from now. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about today, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You'll be the first to find out when we post new episodes, and it helps us get found by other listeners, so we really appreciate it. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and I directly, please send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee.
This podcast will dissolve like so many tears in Spark Plug Coffee, or rain.
Time to die. And cut.